Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WTCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. In this episode, we'll hear from Liz Watson, a member of the WTCM who leads retreats in the UK and beyond. This is part of the Contemplative Path Through the Crisis programme. We hope you enjoy this talk.
Well, hello, I'm Liz Watson, and I live in London, England. And I'm recording these two talks from home during the COVID-19 lockdown. So the two talks are going to focus on two people who left diaries of their own lives, lived in various sorts of confinement. As it happens, they're both from Amsterdam and lived in Amsterdam in the first half of the 20th century. The first one is the teenager Anna Frank, and the second will be the young woman Etty Hillesum. And looking at Anne Frank, I'm going to use the idea of growing up, of maturing, as a focus for looking at her story. And when it comes to Etty Hillesum, I'm going to use obedience as a focusing theme. But I'd like to link the two pieces with some words from a 20th century Welsh poet called Waldo Williams. So we'll begin with Anna Frank in this talk, and the quotation from Waldo Williams I'd like to begin with is this. So they're the first few words of his poem entitled What is Man? He says, "What is living? The broad hall found between narrow walls." I'll read it again. What is living? The broad hall found between narrow walls. And his words there seem to throw out a particular challenge to us just now as we live in our various degrees and manners of confinement during this COVID-19 crisis, pandemic. A lawyer friend of mine once told me that there are more people coming to his office asking about divorce after Christmas than at any other time of the year. And perhaps you understand that. Being confined together, even in our families, even for celebration and according to well-practiced social custom, something we do every year, can make unfamiliar demands on us. We only really know who we are by the relationships we have with others, by the responses we receive from them, and the reactions we return. But when we're confined, our dwelling place can become a sort of intensified echo chamber with voices continually bouncing off the walls and no way to get away from them as we can do in our normal life, you might say. And if those voices which bounce back to us are loving, joyous, and forgiving, then the time of confinement can be a growing medium for deeper love and stronger relationships. We may indeed find a broader hall between the narrow walls. But if it's not like that, the narrow walls can seem to close in on us, while at the same time pushing us as people further apart. And yet these two types of experience are not necessarily as separate and opposed as I have made them seem. stories have been told through all time in which suffering, restriction, and confinement have provided the very conditions in which a deeper and more contented flourishing is born. Well, you may know the story of Anne Frank through reading her diary, visiting the Anne Frank House Museum in Amsterdam, or seeing the play or the movie. But in case you don't know her or need a reminder, here is an outline. When she begins writing the diary by which she is most well known, it is June 1942. Anna is 13 years old, living with mum and dad and older sister Margot in Amsterdam. The family were originally German citizens, but moved to Amsterdam when Anna was 4. They were a Jewish family, but thoroughly assimilated, with mum keeping up the Friday prayers and the major Jewish festivals, but perfectly naturally marking the Dutch Christian feasts as well. They were an educated, cultured family, financed by dad's successful business. When Anna's diary opens, Holland has been occupied by the Nazis since 1940. Restriction and persecution of Jews has escalated. And finally, the Franks decide there is no other choice but to hide out in a set of secret rooms on their business premises, entered through a door hidden behind a bookcase. A few trusted employees support them. And with them come the Van Pels family, mum, dad, and 16-year-old son Peter, and later a dentist, Fritz Pfeffer. So they move into these cramped secret quarters, these narrow halls, on the 20th of June, 1942, remaining and surviving there for 2 years until August the 1st, 1944, when they are discovered and forcibly removed to concentration camps. Anna dies in Bergen-Belsen in the spring of 1945, and only Dad survives. Well, what does it mean for a 13-year-old girl to grow up in circumstances like that? And really, Anna's diary gives us her answer to that question. What does it mean to grow up, to mature at all? Anna writes this at one point. I think it's odd that grown-ups quarrel so easily and so often and about such petty matters. Up to now, I always thought bickering was just something children did and that they outgrew it. This is Anna's comment about the Van Pels grown-ups, the new extension to her family in hiding, whose bickering seems to magnify as days and months go by. She can see that they keep going round in the same hamster wheel, time after time, and never seem to learn from it. Doesn't look like an example of maturity to her. In fact, she begins to think at one point that maybe she is more mature than they are. But at the same time, she knows that she herself is looking for examples to follow as she tries to work out who she is and how she should behave in this very confusing time. Confusing because it's a confusing age to be. Confusing because life in what she calls the secret annex is a topsy-turvy life to be catapulted into. And confusing because the world at large has been turned upside down in a terrifying way. One of the features of living between narrow walls is that you see people in detail and in close-up in a way that you don't normally. Anna is a very good observer of others from the start. But what also begins to open up is an ability to observe herself with a degree of detachment. In one of her last diary entries, she writes, "I have one outstanding trait in my character, which must strike anyone who knows me for any length of time. And that is my knowledge of myself. I can watch myself and my actions just like an outsider." Well, there's still a great deal of self-consciousness in it, but the work of real growing up has begun, as it always must, with self-knowledge. She often feels that within these walls, she is constantly assailed by barrages of criticism. She writes, "If I talk, everyone thinks I'm showing off. When I'm silent, they think I'm ridiculous. Rude if I answer, sly if I get a good idea, lazy if I'm tired, selfish if I eat a mouthful more than I should, stupid, cowardly, crafty, etc., etc., etc. The whole day long, I hear that I am nothing else but that I'm an insufferable baby." Well, that's a hard, intense place to be growing up. And with no other physical place to go and no other friends to turn to for a restorative perspective, the only option, she finds, is her diary. "When I write," she writes, "I shake off all my cares." And in her diary, she describes the way she copes with all this criticism she feels is coming at her. It's as though she's thrashing about between answering back, justifying herself to herself, making sure to get the last word, trying to say nothing, resolving to be better, standing her ground, criticizing herself, resentment at others, trying to learn from it, feeling low, weeping on her pillow, falling into confusion, often ending with that great adolescent cry of pain, frustration, and loneliness. "No one understands me." At one point, she wishes she could be someone else, but remarkably quickly realizes that you cannot escape your own nature, and it is pointless to imagine you can. You just have to learn to deal with it. And it is very much in her favor that she does indeed want to learn, hard though that turns out to be, for her, as indeed it is for us all. Looking back through her diary after a year in confinement, though, she's surprised and pleased to see signs of change, of maturing. She writes, "I have grown up a bit. I've grown wiser." How does she recognize that? She is both shocked to think that she could earlier have written of hating her mother, and pleased now that her tense and difficult relationship with her mother is easing a little. She writes, "I usually keep my mouth shut if I get annoyed, and so does she. So we appear to get on much better." And her attitude to the vexing Van Pelt's parents has changed too. She writes, "I suddenly see all the arguments and the rest of it in a different light. And I'm not as prejudiced as I was." She hopes that she's acquiring some insight, a sort of penetrating insight, which can make a difference to how she responds to people. She begins to think that a real, as distinct from a superficial Anna, is emerging. A true self, or a second Anna, she calls it. She can see that this real self is better, deeper, and purer than the other, and she likes it very much. One day, when she's sitting close to the Van Pels' son, Petter, she writes, "Suddenly, the ordinary Anna slipped away, and a second Anna took her place. A second Anna who is not reckless and jocular, but one who just wants to love and be gentle. And yet she continually finds it so hard to allow this second Anna to flourish. The first Anna so quickly pushes aside the second when it makes an appearance, so that no one else gets to see it and acknowledge and encourage it. Or if it does stay for a few moments, others are surprised. She herself doesn't know how to cope with it, and the first Anna flips it over with a joke and locks it back down into the secret place of isolation within. Yet she longs to be real. Let her real thoughts and feelings be known and shared. She soon begins to get some insight into what drives her ways of relating. She has always loved to be amusing and jokey, centre of attention, with a little crowd of admirers and followers round her. Exhausting, though, she realises. And at its root, she can now see it works as a way of banishing a frightening emptiness inside. How much better it would be, she can see so readily now, to set aside that superficial posing, undergo the loss of the admirers and followers, and find instead a few good, real friends who might begin to assuage her loneliness and allow her to be true. But when she contemplates such possibilities, long comes the cry of frustration. But you won't listen to the advice given to you by your own better half. And to make it worse, when she does begin to find a streak of new strength and courage within her, it goes wrong. Her parents have asked her to draw back from the burgeoning romantic attachment between herself and Peter. She certainly does not intend to do that, rather the opposite. And she writes to her father to say so, claiming a hard-won independence at the age of now 14, denouncing any sense of responsibility towards her parents, who, she writes, have not supported her in the past year anyway. Her father is uncharacteristically deeply wounded by her letter. Both end up in tears when they sit down to talk about it. Afterwards, Anna understands so clearly that her letter was harsh and untrue, and she is ashamed that she could actually have been proud of it when she wrote it. Her father's ready forgiveness makes her even more ashamed. But she writes, "It's right that for once I've been taken down from my pedestal, that my pride has been shaken for a bit, for I was becoming too much taken up with myself again. Anyone who can cause such unhappiness to someone else, someone she professes to love, and on purpose too, is very, very low. Get it wrong is only human. To seek to justify one's actions, to defend oneself, is an equally all too human reaction. But to see the situation with crystal clarity and accept your responsibility without self-justification as Anna is clearly able to do this time. This is where some real growing up, some real maturing begins. It would be wonderful to go on to say that gradually she does find the inner confidence and humility, security and freedom she needs, and that she does continue to develop the greater love and compassion which naturally flow from this way of maturing from the inside out. But the diary is nearly at its end, so we cannot know. In fact, the diary ends on a low note. It goes, "And finally I twist my heart round again, so that the bad is on the outside and the good is on the inside, and keep on trying to find a way of becoming what I would so like to be and what I could be if there weren't any other people living in the world." Right from the start, though, she keeps glimpsing something about herself, which is lodged very deep in the inner recesses of her heart, and which she begins to suspect underlies her many troubles. She's constantly longing for an intimacy she cannot find with any other person, and feels a penetrating, isolating loneliness within herself that she has no idea how to cure. Being at close quarters with her family and the other residents of the secret annex turns out to be the opposite of a remedy in the beginning. Instead of feeling a deeper love, support, and understanding in these dangerous, fragile, and frightening times, she quickly begins to feel deserted, and more than that, as though she is surrounded by a great threatening void. There is none of the usual fun and distractions with her friends, so she's prey to thoughts about unhappy things or about herself. Even worse, she is brought face to face with the realization that her beloved daddy, who is so very, very dear to her, cannot and will never be able to fill this void. Where then can she turn? Gradually she gets to know the Van Pelsis' son, Peter, rather shy and turned in on himself. She thinks she might be able to help him open up, and thereby find a new friend to share her heart with. A romance develops with all the excitement and palpitations of the heart that go along with the first embrace, the first kiss, and the promise of being able to share intimate matters. And yet, it isn't enough. And in any case, she feels he is beginning to lean on her, instead of learning to stand on his own feet, which she feels would be bad for them both. There is only her diary. Kitty, she calls her diary, because it is like the best sort of friend to her, a real friend. Anna loves the quote, "Paper is patient." "I want to write, but more than that, I want to bring out all kinds of things that lie buried deep in my heart." In a diary, you can pour your heart out, what you really think and feel. You don't have to hold back. You won't be judged, condemned, or misunderstood. You can be serious and fearless. You can safely enter your inner room when you write to dear Kitty. Is God there too? Well, yes, in a shadowy way, and beginning to emerge from the shadows, but not yet to take the place of Kitty or become the ultimate source of love and intimacy she longs for, or the way to transmute the void into a broad hall to dwell in. Returning finally to the theme of maturing, growing up. She's already realized that maturing isn't easy. It's much easier to live a superficial life and reconcile yourself to that. But in the end, she writes, all these troubles have made me older.
Hi everyone, you're listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative spiritual and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Just a quick reminder, if you like this show, be sure to subscribe, and if you want to learn more about the important work of the WCCM, you can find us online at wccm.org. And now, back to our show.
Welcome to the second of these two talks. In the first talk, we met Anna Frank, who was writing her diary from her hiding place in Amsterdam between June 1942 and July 1944. Well, in this talk, we're going to meet Etty Hillesum. And Etty was writing her diary also in Amsterdam, indeed, only a mile and a half down the road from Anna Frank's house. And she was writing between March 1941 and October 1942. Or at least that's what of her diary has survived. The last notebook that she wrote in was lost. And we have some letters of hers that helped to fill in that gap until her death in November 1943. And in looking at Etty for this talk, I want to focus on two themes. The first one is the linking theme I'm using for both Anna and Etty, which is the idea of finding a broad hall between narrow walls. And the other theme I want to use is the theme of obedience. Well, that might seem like a rather unlikely pairing, but let's see how we go. So let's begin with the theme I started the first talk with, that quote from Welsh poet Waldo Williams, the opening words. What is living? Broad hall found between narrow walls. Well, I find this a very attractive idea, that you can find freedom and spaciousness in situations of limitation and restriction. But what has to happen for it to happen? Can it just happen? Or do we have to do something? Some recent research in the UK showed that a majority of people surveyed hoped that the world would be a better place after COVID-19. They could see good things happening and emerging and were optimistic about them continuing. Yet at the same time, most people wanted things to go back to normal as soon as possible. So maybe change would be desirable. But if that means I have to be one of the ones who changes, maybe I'm not so sure about that. Perhaps we instinctively know that the sort of personal change which makes a real difference is not so easily won. We do have to do something, undergo something. But what? And what if we have to call upon the unpopular, even threatening, Christian virtue of obedience? I wonder if you listened to Sarah Batchelard's marvellous series of talks under the title A Living Hope, The Shape of Christian Virtue. If you did, you might remember her talking about obedience as really the virtue of virtues in Christian thought. And as she began to talk about it, I found myself thinking of Etty Hillesum, and that her life, what we find in her diaries, might be a very good way to see how this sort of obedience works out in a life not so very remote from our own. Well, who was Etty? Etty was a Dutch Jew, a secular Jew, born in 1914, murdered in Auschwitz in 1943 at the age of 29. In the last 18 months of her life, she wrote a diary, which was eventually published along with her letters from the period. During this time, as I said earlier, she was living in Amsterdam. And maybe you don't need reminding of the sort of restrictions she was subject to as a Jew in a Nazi regime. There were increasing limitations on what Jews could buy, where they could go, how they could earn a living, who they could meet with, how they could move about. And in Etty's case, along with thousands of others, it meant removal to a transit camp just outside the city, and eventually transport from there to the death camps. How is it possible even to begin to think about notions like freedom and spaciousness amid all of that? It seems a ridiculous idea. And what could obedience have to do with it? Even more ridiculous. And it is ridiculous if obedience only means to bow to external authority in fear and trembling, exactly the terror that was going on in Amsterdam. But what if we start with Father Lawrence's understanding of obedience? He puts it like this. Obedience is not doing what you're told, but becoming the word you hear. I'll say that again. Obedience is not doing what you're told, but becoming the word you hear. And that draws us back to the root meaning of the word obedience from the Latin verb meaning to listen. It reminds me of the story of the Transfiguration. Out of the cloud on the mountaintop is heard the voice, "This is my son, my beloved. Listen to him." And the hearers are stunned into silence. What they hear is a revelation and an invitation. There is something utterly extraordinary going on here, and yet it is a simple invitation to enter into this beautiful relationship between father and son. The listening called forth from them, and for us, is a transformative listening from the heart, from the depths of our being, in which there is only love, a love which has no place for fear, which takes us way beyond words and reveals who we really are. Well, we don't all have revelations of that sort on mountaintops. But we do all have some sort of awakening. Letty's first awakening was a listening into herself, which painfully revealed long suppressed truths about herself. Outwardly young, vibrant, intense, passionate, educated, cultured, independent, a lover, a teacher, a writer, she suddenly confronted with a stark and only just bearable sense of shame and fear. She puts it like this: I seem to be a match for most of life's problems, and yet deep down, something like a tightly wound ball of twine binds me relentlessly, and at times I am nothing more or less than a miserable, frightened creature. It's hard indeed to hear that in yourself and not reject it. It takes courage not to recoil from, as she puts it, a slice of chaos staring at me from deep down inside my soul. Courage not to hear that and snatch back control again. 18 months later, she sums up her life in these terms: truly, my life is one long listening into myself and into others, into God. And if I say that I listen, it is really God who listens inside me. The most essential and deepest in me, listening into the most essential and deepest in the other. God to God. Letty's diaries reveal a continuing struggle going on in her. But the struggle becomes less and less a struggle to keep everything under control, and more a struggle to be obedient to what is growing in her from deep within. And that's a very different matter. Letty finds that an inner impulse can push its way through at any moment, quite unexpected. Here's one of them. I suddenly went down on my knees, almost automatically, forced to the ground by something stronger than myself. The language of force and something stronger than myself could ring alarm bells. Except that in the next sentence, she describes this force as creative, and the act of kneeling as an intimate gesture of love. Kneeling seemed alien and embarrassing to her at first, but it quickly becomes a treasured activity which gives physical expression to an urgent need and desire she had been quite unaware of previously. She writes, a desire to kneel, as though my body had been made for the act of kneeling. To respond to a gifted impulse is one thing. To be obedient to the invitation it brings to learn to listen into God as a way of life requires freely undertaken discipline. Etty realizes that she has to learn to practice prayer, including meditation. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice, lose myself. You could call it meditation. She also has to listen to her teacher, listen into the Bible, and to writers who speak profoundly of God, and write her diary. And as the diaries proceed, we see the reality of God unfold for her as a fruit of this sort of obedience. God, she discovers in her experience and understanding, is love, joy, peace, beautiful, rich, intimate, mystery, silence, simplicity, faithful. All around her, hatred, ugliness, violence, inhumanity, betrayal, fear, and desperation seem to be stamping out the good. And yet Etty comes to see that the ultimate truths of God are exactly that, ultimate. Nothing can destroy them. They always endure and are utterly trustworthy. Even when so hidden, it takes a very clear and penetrating eye to see them. She writes, "The misery here is quite terrible. And yet, late at night, when the day has slunk away into the depths behind me, I often walk with a spring in my step along the barbed wire. And then, time and again, it soars straight from my heart. I can't help it. That's just the way it is, like some elementary force. The feeling that life is glorious and magnificent. At other times, it takes a great deal of determination to marshal thoughts which have spun off down dark, chaotic, destructive alleyways. But in the end, she comes back to things like this. I shall always feel safe in God's arms. They may well succeed in breaking me physically, but no more than that. I may face cruelty and deprivation, the like of which I cannot imagine. Yet all this is as nothing to the immeasurable expanse of my faith in God and my inner receptiveness." Well, who are you listening into? Who are you hearing? Who are you obeying? When you listen into, when you hear, when you obey God. On the one hand, Etty thinks of a deep well inside herself in which God dwells. Sometimes she is there too, but often there is a blockage of stones and grit which has to be cleared away. Yet that God she hears is also her own voice. Quote, "And that probably expresses my own love of life. I repose in myself, and that part of myself, that deepest and richest part in which I repose, is what I call God." What first seemed to be a force outside herself now seems to have become herself. It is a reoriented self. Reoriented from a depth within herself she didn't know she possessed, from a blessed silence growing within, from an inner spaciousness she could never have dreamed of, from a receptiveness to love which is beyond any human love she has experienced. Recall Father Lawrence's words. "Obedience is not doing what you are told, but becoming the word you hear." So when you are you obedient to God or to yourself? Are you doing what someone else wants or what you want? The distinction between yourself as subject and God as object simply breaks down. The word you are hearing is changing you, and you cannot help being true to your transformed self. Early in the diaries, Etty says, "Something in me is growing, And every time I look inside, something fresh has appeared. And all I have to do is accept it, to take it upon myself, to bear it forward, and to let it flourish. That's the dynamic of obedience, which begins to work in us as we commit ourselves to meditation. Etty again. He enclosed a quotation, "And yet God is love." I completely agree. And it is truer now than ever. This growing conviction is what gives Etty's life meaning and purpose in this landscape of appalling suffering and destruction. A meaning and direction she had despaired of ever finding before. Once you learn to listen into God, you can't help listening into yourself and to others. You simply become a person who listens and hears. If you are truly hearing God, you are hearing love, whose nature is to reverberate in you and through you to others. For Etty, it works out like this. Something else about this morning, the perception very strongly borne in, that despite all the suffering and injustice, I cannot hate others. Sometimes that is nearly impossible for Etty to do. It takes all her strength and resolve when she's faced with the brutality of soldiers and the misery of innocent people. At other times, love wells up in her spontaneously. Increasingly, it becomes an abiding disposition. She writes, "I keep discovering that there is no causal connection between people's behavior and the love you feel for them. Love for one's fellow man is like an elemental glow that sustains you. Mainly," she discovers, "it has to be lived hour by hour, wherever she finds herself." As she puts it, "all the strength and love and faith in God that one possesses must be there for everyone who chances to cross one's path and who needs it." In the last phase of her life, Etty goes to work in the dreaded transit camp, caring for those incarcerated there. She can see that what God has grown in her is what is needed there in the camp. And so the camp is where she must be. A compassion has grown in her, which compels her to share the destiny of her people, rendering her strong enough to be with them in their suffering. She also carries the precious gift of being able to listen in and read people. How great are the needs of your creatures on this earth, O God. They sit there, talking quietly and quite unsuspecting, and suddenly their need erupts in all its nakedness. Then there they are, bundles of human misery, desperate and unable to face life. And that's when my task begins. It is not enough to proclaim you, God, to commend you to the hearts of others. One must clear the path towards you in them, God. And to do that, one has to be a keen judge of the human soul. I embark on a slow voyage of exploration with everyone who comes to me. And I thank you for the gift of being able to read people. And I promise you, yes, I promise, that I shall try to find a dwelling and a refuge for you in as many houses as possible. There are so many empty houses, and I shall prepare them all for you, the most honored lodger. Well, let's return to the beginning in order to end. What is living? Broad hall found between narrow walls. What Etty discovered was that privation and suffering forced her to dig down to the few things that really matter in life and focus on them. We'll end with her words. People here fritter their energy away on the thousand irksome details that grind us down every day. That's why they get driven off course and find existence pointless. The few big things that matter in life are what we have to keep in mind. The rest can be quietly abandoned. And you can find those few big things anywhere. You have to keep rediscovering them in yourself so that you can be renewed. And in spite of everything, you always end up with the same conviction. Life is good after all. It's not God's fault things go awry sometimes. The cause lies in ourselves. And that's what stays with me, even now. Even when I am about to be packed off to Poland.
You've been listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. To learn more about our guest or anything else mentioned in the episode, please check out the links in the show notes or visit us online at wccm.org.